and that her husband claimed she had travelled to France to visit sick relatives. William was no longer listening. "Wait," he said. "This man with the pocket watch, this witness to the Farquhar heist."
"Sir?"
"From the passenger liner. Who was he? What did he see?"
"A doctor from Liverpool, sir.
He said he had a pocket watch stolen from him while on board, and that he encountered the thief at Mr. Farquhar's gallery shortly before the theft. He seemed quite insistent about it."
"That's all. Nothing useful. What did the man look like?"
"The doctor?"
"The thief."
Blackwell cleared his throat. "He claimed he was a gentleman travelling over from Boston with his young daughter. A smaller man. White hair, well-groomed. Piercing eyes."
William smiled. He watched a wagon inch up alongside them, its high wet wheels spitting mud. "Did anyone else talk to him?"
"I filed the report, sir, but it seemed a rather unreliable account."
"And this man from Brighton? This would be Ellen Shorter's father, I guess."
Blackwell nodded. He told William the curious thing was that this man had heard nothing of any sick relatives himself. He believed his daughter had come into some trouble. He said he did not like the husband, nor trust him.
"And you were already investigating Shorter?"
"Yes, sir."
"Fair bit of luck there."
William set a hand on the rail of the hansom as it jounced over the granite setts.
"What does Shorter say to all this?"
"I had a constable in to talk to him. He says his wife was estranged from her father. She told the man nothing for years. He says his father-in-law is in debt to him for several hundred pounds."
"Sure. Whose elbows are the more frayed?"
"I beg your pardon, sir."
"Doesn't matter."
He waved a hand. "Tell me something. How much of this is gut feeling, Blackwell?"
"Gut feeling, sir?"
"Instinct, yes." Blackwell bristled. "It's detective work, sir. Logic."
William smiled, turned away. 2/3 of this job is done when you're not thinking about anything, Inspector. It's your gut tells you what's what. The trick is learning to trust it.
The Baker's Dwarf was an ancient tavern at the edge of Edgware Road, directly across the field from where the grisly torso was found. It had been built in the 18th century, Blackwell told him, as an overnight house for travellers into London to change horses. That was in an age of highwaymen, when London was confined to its own limits, and nightfall set the hours of a man's living. Now the city had devoured its outliers, and what had once been an outpost was a casual drinking house for labourers coming off shift. There were fewer people in the streets there at that hour. The Dwarf was a crooked, freestanding tavern with rooms to let above, and an ancient faded sign hanging on its chains over the lintel. A weak gas lamp was burning even during the daylight hours, but it shed no light, and William shivered and turned up the collar of his coat against the chill. The air was grey with a weak mist.
"Is it warmer inside, do you think?" William muttered.
"I fear not, sir." They stamped the cold from their boots and shut the door with a bang, and made their way across to the bar. There were figures huddled at tables nursing their pints, and two languid whores blinking sleepily from a corner, and William and Blackwell shook the weather from their sleeves and took off their hats, and William called for whiskey, and the narrow door to the kitchen swung wide, and out came the proprietor Shorter himself. William looked at his face, and looked at his eyes, and he knew him at once for a killer. It was nothing he could have articulated had he been asked. A faint crackling in the skin as the man emerged, a kind of red darkness in the eyelids. Shorter was enormous, thick-necked, his blue eyes bulging from their sockets as he made his way towards them. There was a power to his movements, but he was slow and heavy. William had ridden out with his father once against a grizzly that had been killing stock, and the man Shorter had something of that creature's loose, rippling power in his shoulders. He was bearded, and his voice was loud as a prophet's calling them to account.
"What'll it be, then?"
he boomed, and set both broad palms down on the counter and smiled. William smiled back. The man loomed a full head taller than him, but he had struck down men half as big again in blacker days.
"Whiskey," he said again, "the finest you have." "American, eh?"
Shorter reached down under the counter and drew out a dusty bottle and two glasses upended between his knuckles.
"Ye never tippled a whiskey until ye tasted some of this." William glanced deliberately around the room. "Where's the wife?"
"What?"
"The missus." Shorter smile faltered.
"Do you know her?"
William held up a hand. "Not as such," he said. "We came through here this time last year, and she was awful nice to us."
"Where you lads from, then?"
Shorter asked. He had not uncorked the bottle, and now he leaned across and drew out an ale, and cut the foam and slid the pint across to a man in coveralls, with his head down on the brass railing of the bar.
"Florida? The both of ye?"
William glanced at Blackwell, glanced back.
"Yes."
Shorter chuckled.
"He don't look like a Yankee."
"He's a Canadian."
"And what brings you through to England?"
William shrugged.
"Oh, business. Pleasure." "Which one is it?"
William laughed.
"That depends. What class of bottle you keep here?"
The bottle was standing yet between them. Shorter set both stout hands on the bar and took a deep breath, and his chest thickened and widened, and the seams of his coat stretched. His nostrils flared as he smiled.
"This here's the finest whiskey in any city establishment what don't require you to pay for membership. Down out of the Hebrides, it is."
William let his eye pass across it, and then the other bottles ranged behind the bar.
"I'd not lie to you."
William glanced at Blackwell, smiled at Shorter. "You don't have anything a little more expensive?"
"You won't try this?"
William lifted his eyebrows. Shorter's smile went very tight.
"We might just could have,"
he said.
"It'll cost you."
William reached into his pocket and set a £5 note on the bar.
"The both of ye has the first."
Shorter looked at Blackwell and smiled his flushed, wide smile.
"Don't he have a tongue in his head?"
"He likes to do his talking with a glass in front of him," said William. The three of them stood in silence for a moment, Blackwell smiling. At last, Shorter rooted a thumb around in one nostril and sniffed sharply.
"All right, then,"
he said.
"Come on and I'll show it to you. She takes all kinds, this world, she do. Bets?"
he shouted. A haggard old woman appeared at the kitchen door.
"What?"
"You watch the front a while. I'll be taking these gents down for a peek at the queer."
"Down to where?"
He gestured with his thumb.
"Down below."
"Down to where, you say?"
He waved a hand at her, turned away. He had withdrawn from under the counter a greasy lantern and now took it across to the cinder fire and opened its glass door and lit the wick and shut it again carefully. They followed him down through a small passage behind the bar. The stairs were ancient and made of wood and rattled dangerously under their weight. Shorter led the way, his huge back and hairy neck blocking their sight. William felt a tension run through him, a kind of electricity, like the feeling in his skin when he would stand in the wheat fields as a boy and watch a lightning storm roll in. The cellar stank of damp and sawdust and night soil, and William squinted as they came down. The ceiling was low, the rough floor hewn from rock, and the lantern glinted and shivered off slime on the walls. Ranged along two walls were rows of barrels and cords of firewood, and along a third leaned a shelf of bottles all staggered and askew. William tried to catch Blackwell's eye, but the inspector was following Shorter across to the dusty corner bottles. The floor near the stairs was covered in sawdust from a chopping block, but the dust looked strangely deep and evenly distributed, and covered the floor some full 5 feet from the block itself. William drew a crescent in the sawdust with his heel. There were bloodstains soaked into the floor.
"What happened here?"
he said. Shorter straightened from where he had been kneeling among the bottles and laughed.
"Bloody butcher's strike,"
he said. He turned back nonchalantly. William walked over to the chopping block and lifted up the axe. He could see even in the bad light a faint matting of dried blood and hair.
"You use an axe for that?" "Sometimes I do,"
he said.
"I believe we'd like to ask you a few questions, sir,"
Blackwell said. Shorter shook his head.
"Funny accent for a Canadian,"
he said.
"Yes,"
said William. He was still holding the axe.
"Where did you say your wife was, sir?"
Shorter gave the smaller inspector a quick, fierce glance,
but then his eyes settled on William.
"You mean to kill me?" he said. "Whatever he's to payin' ye, I'll double it."
"Put down the bottle," said William. "We're not here to harm you, sir." Blackwell took a step forward. "I'm Detective Inspector Blackwell of the Yard. This is my associate."
"The hell ye are."
"Put down the bottle," William said again.
"What's happened to your wife, sir?"
Blackwell said quietly. Shorter's face had gone grey, and the muscles in his big shoulders were cording and bunching, and William thought for an uneasy moment that the man would need to be struck down. But it was not rage, but regret, which made the man tremble. He stared at the bottle in his hands as if he did not know it, and then he set it carefully down on the floor, and he stood with his head bowed, and his long, greasy hair fallen forward.
"Mr. Shorter, sir, would you like to tell us about it?"
"I never meant nothing to happen to her," he said in a whisper.
"I understand, sir."
"It weren't planned."
He looked up. He had started to tremble.
"She were going to leave me."
"Yes."
"I caught her at it, red-handed like. I known something was wrong and made some excuse to go out for an errand on a Monday night. Then I come back in, quiet, caught her upstairs in the bar with her bags all packed for Gravesend. She were dressed in a man's suit, and she was a-meaning to rendezvous with some bastard painter. Had cut her hair off, and the like."
"What happened, sir?"
Shorter put out a big hand and rested it on the shelf of bottles, and the glass rolled and clinked under his weight.
"I hit her. I never meant it to hurt her. I hit her with an open hand, I swear to God. But her eyes just rolled up in her head and she fell down dead right on the floor."
Shorter glanced up at William, who stood yet with the axe at his side.
"I brung her down here and tied her up and poked her a couple of times to see if she were going to wake up. I thought she might be trying to trick me, see. She were clever like that. But she were dead. I didn't know what to do."
"So you cut her into pieces," William said. The man's heavy eyes shut fast, and he swayed on his feet, but he said nothing.
"What happened to the painter, sir?"
"Michael Whitten," Shorter said softly. "I went looking for the bastard, I did."
"And?"
"And I cut his throat while he was sleeping."
"Where is he now?"
Shorter stared glassily at them.
"Somewhere's in the river,"
he murmured.
"I'd do it a second time if he was to rise right up out of the grave and walk down them stairs, so help me God I would."
"We'll need to put some restraints on you, sir,"
Blackwell said calmly. Shorter nodded. The inspector took from his pocket the ancient wrist shackles and adjusted their screws and set them on the big man's wrists, and the tavern keeper made no effort to resist. William scowled.
"Except your wife didn't die from being struck," he said. "She was poisoned."
"Poisoned?
The chloroform."
The man blinked, turned a heel in the sawdust.
"It wasn't all quite so accidental and unplanned as you say, was it?"
"I loved her," Shorter said. "Fine way of showing it,"
William said angrily. He started kicking through the mess of the cellar. "There isn't enough blood here for that kind of cutting up," he said.
"Mr. Shorter, sir?"
Blackwell said, but the tavern keeper was staring down at his shackled hands and said nothing. And then William found it, a small locked door under the stairs. He broke it open and found a narrow shaft that once must have held firewood, and at the bottom he could see a loose rope and a pair of men's shoes. The walls of the shaft were black with blood.
"Shorter,"
William said. He turned back and crossed the cellar and sat on an upturned crate facing the enormous man.
"Did Ellen confess to her affair?"
He looked up.
"She never did,"
he said.
"She were too mighty clever for that."
"And did Whitten confess before he died?"
Shorter's face twisted.
"I never gave him the chance,"
he spat. But there was no fight in the man, and he did not struggle against them. William stamped up out of the cellar and called out a guinea to the first man who returned with a constable, and went back down to find Blackwell lighting a pipe for the tavern keeper. The three of them made their heavy way back up the stairs, and stood in the kitchen among the grimy pots, and the knives, and a roasting pig, and waited. When a constable arrived, William gave Blackwell a long, weary look, and then went out, and he was surprised to hear Blackwell come out behind him. The street was cold, the air damp. William pulled on his gloves. The door banged shut behind them. "Let me ask you something," he said. "What are the chances of someone else being involved?"
"Someone else, sir?"
"A Confederate. Someone with a motive. Someone linked to the Flash."
"In this?"
Blackwell was studying him with his hooded eyes.
"I don't see how, sir."
"If you mean to suggest the letter from Mr. Whitten was false..." William rubbed at his eyes. "Alan Shorter might just as easily have been running from her husband without any lover being involved."
"And the letter, sir?"
William frowned. There was something in it that troubled him, but it might only be the ordinary, shabby mystery of any killing. It was a thing he could not get used to. The faded wooden sign creaked on its chains over the doorway. "Never mind it," he said reluctantly, and nodded at the young inspector. "You did fine work here, Blackwell." Blackwell flushed.
"Thank you, sir."
But William had already turned away. He was thinking of Shade and other kinds of jealousy, and of the strange, elusive bond between the thief and his own father. "Love is a quiet and quicksilver thing, and best left unjudged," Margaret liked to say. He had a sudden memory of her, one elbow propped on the lining of a carriage door, her head cradled in her palm as she peered sidelong at him and smiled. A waft of gardenias. Where had that been? He closed his eyes and rubbed at his temples and knew he had been too long from home.
"Shall I fetch you a cab, sir?"
Blackwell said. He stared at the inspector as if he had forgotten the man's presence, and then he shook his head.
"No,"
he said. "Thanks. I'll find my own way." And lowered his hat and drew on his gloves and walked back through the narrow stone streets alone, towards the city. A man descending. 39.
"Just don't you ask me to trust her," Molly said at breakfast that first day,
running a bitten thumb under red-rimmed eyes, scowling. An egg was gleaming in its shell before her, her spoon ablaze with light like some offering of grace.
"Oi,"
Flood grunted later on the stairs, wrapping his huge hand over the balustrade and lowering his voice.
"Molly ain't wrong about her, Mr. Edom. That sort is like to steal the bleeding shoes off your feet, they is."
To both he had listened in silence, and studied them with hooded eyes, and scratched at his whiskers and turned away. For some strange, dark fascination had bloomed again in him. He brooded and weighed Charlotte's intention to free her uncle from the prison transport in Chichester, but he could not think his way through it. She had asked for his help, and he had wanted to say no, but had not. He knew whatever he had shared with her would, of course, never be again as it was. Meanwhile, Flood knuckled his beard, glowered blackly, and Molly stamped from room to room in displeasure. Charlotte kept apart.
"Aha,"
Molly muttered at that.
"Too good for us, is she?"
Flood lifted an eyebrow, pointedly. Fool himself reeled, light-headed. When he knew where Charlotte was, he avoided her, and when he did not, he drifted from room to room, floor to floor, seeking her out. He did not defend her to his companions, but neither did he attack her, and this reticence was mistaken by Molly for weakness, by Flood for strength. Fool, unfocused, knew it to be neither. In the afternoon he felt a presence at his back, and then her fingers were resting on his neck, on his throat, and he heard her murmur,
"I forgot how your skin smells. Like river water."
But when he turned she was not there. That night, as he went upstairs with a candle guttering before him, he found her on the landing, grey and indistinct, like an apparition, and when he held the flame high he saw she had been crying. He did not breathe. She stepped forward, and took his free hand, and held it to her breast, her fingers like ice, the hot wax dripping and singeing his other wrist. When he tried to kiss her she pulled away. She glared at him, inexplicably. She disappeared into the gloom. The next day was Monday. Fool and Molly and Flood sat in the back room of the Emporium, poring over the dailies, working through the details of their plan. Saturday's heist had made the front page of most London papers, and the public outcry was magnificent. Some blamed the Irish, some the French. An editorial in the London World hinted at George Farquhar's own involvement. There was speculation as to the painting's true value, and the nation's claim to the precious artwork. The auction date was postponed. Subscribers wrote letters with advice to the police as how to trace the painting. Others described suspicious persons seen at the docks, at the train stations. Fool red with impatience, the red drapes drawn thickly over the daylight, the gaslights burning low. Flood lost interest, picked idly through armfuls of wool batting in an open crate. Then he spat dust from his beard and reached with both hands into the box, and withdrew, very carefully, a polished wooden mask. Strands of human hair twisting from its forehead, the scoop of its interior stained dark, as if with blood.
"Now this could be useful," he snorted. "What do you reckon it is? A disguise?"
The mask leering its twisted leer, dozens of tiny human teeth embedded in circles around the eye sockets, ancient coins of some Spanish minting knotted and clattering from the jawline. A gruesome thing, a frightening thing, ugly. Flood held it to his face, peered through its slitted sockets. His muffled voice.
"And how do me face look now?"
"Much improved,"
Molly laughed. Flood pulled it away, looked at Fool.
"Well," he said, "anything to make us reconsider?"
"The exchange?" "No."
Fool rotated his wrist, hearing the joint crack.
"Farquhar should be encouraged by all of the publicity. It should guarantee him a strong sale in his auction. The letter instructed him that Gabriel would be in contact. He'll wait for it. We'll move on Friday."
"Plucking a picture,"
Molly muttered.
"Not so much as a finger on his old bloody palace full of diamonds, but the picture, sure."
Fool held up a hand.
"Gabriel will write to Farquhar on Thursday with details. Expect the man at 11 o'clock, Billingsgate, as arranged. It will be for you, Molly, to meet with him. You'll work the open. Japheth and I will work the close. You know him by sight?"
"Poncy bugger like him. I don't expect the challenge."
"And the peelers?" Flood said. "Billingsgate stairs like to be crawling with them. You don't trust him to come alone."
Fool shook his head. "He won't involve the police unduly. I expect some few to be there for safety. Farquhar is a man of some importance, but he wants his painting. He won't risk losing it. And constables on the embankment won't trouble us any."
"Aye."
Flood leaned forward, sawed at his beard with the back of his hand.
"Because of the river. You engaged the steamers, kid?"
Molly nodded.
"They're just waiting on the second payment."
She glanced from Fool to Flood and back again.
"You sure the peelers won't be able to follow?"
"Unless they swim like fish."
"But I don't swim like no fish,"
Molly said abruptly.
"I swim like a bloody anchor."
"Best not to fall in the drink, then."
Flood grinned.
"Adam?"
"You'll be fine, Molly. There won't be any complications." "We can tie a rope to you,"
Flood suggested. Molly furrowed her brow.
"And you two? You all set then yourselves for your part?"
"Japheth?" "Oi, there's a farrier up Albert Courts what rents out his old growler. I'll see to him in the morning. You finished with your moulding, Mr. Edam?"
Fool nodded. "I will be. There's one last thing. Mrs. Sykes has procured a second residence for us, in Newington. It seems the owners are out of England for the year. It'll do fine for us. We'll need to relocate there at once. Mrs. Sykes and Hetty will close up the emporium and stay on here."
Flood looked at Molly.
"Because bloody Pinkerton come by here?"
"Yes."
"You really reckon he's such a problem? With the Emma and all? I don't see how he could know it were us, Mr. Edam. There won't even be no charges laid, if Farquhar holds true.
We just need to keep our heads low for a few more days. I don't mean to invite complications by allowing William Pinkerton to visit at his leisure."
"And what do you aim to do with her ladyship?"
Molly said sarcastically.
"Her ladyship?"
"Aye, by that you mean Charlotte. I weren't talking about Jappy."
"You joke,"
Flood said.
but I'll make a pretty piece and a girdle."
Fool was looking at Molly, her eyes small and glinting weirdly in the gaslit sconces.
"Charlotte is not a part of this," he said softly. "We don't bring her into it. Tell her nothing."
Molly set her jaw.
"You mean to leave her here, then?" she pressed. "With Mrs. Sykes?"
"Not exactly."
Flood was picking at some seam of dirt in his palm, rubbing it out with the ball of one thumb as if to erase his fate. He met Fool's eye.
"What Molly's saying is, it's a question of trust. We don't neither of us suppose it were just coincidence, Pinkerton being in London and Charlotte writing to you to take on a job. She's a ricket, Mr. Edam. You'd be wise to take that serious-like."
They all three sat enshrouded in a troubled silence, and then Fool rose with his walking stick and opened the door, and leaned into the hallway and called loudly for Charlotte. He banged twice on the banister, and the sound rattled up through the house. He turned back and left the door standing open.
"Charlotte has somewhere to get to," he said. "I don't mean Newington. I want you to hear it from her."
Molly was on her feet.
"Easy, kid,"
Flood said. Charlotte appeared in the doorway, then came in, pausing just inside the door and casting a quick, unreadable look at Fool. She clasped her hands before her, and her knuckles turned white, and she regarded the three of them.
"What is this?"
she said.
"Tell them what you told me," Fool said. "What you mean to do."
She did not hesitate.
"My uncle is in Millbank," she said. "I mean to follow his transport when he is moved to Portsmouth on Wednesday. I mean to help him escape. I've asked Adam to help me."
For a long moment, no one spoke.
"That's a part of it you failed to mention, like," said Flood slowly.
"It's a bloody joke," Molly said. "Tell us you told her no."
Charlotte was staring at Fool with a steady, dark, hopeful eye, and Fool looked away, embarrassed.
"He's her uncle, Japheth," he said. "I don't expect you to understand."
"You said yes,"
Flood interrupted.
"It was not a question."
Fool nodded.
"It's like to be dangerous."
"Yes."
"You mean to do it alone? To break that old bastard out?"
"Not alone," Fool said. "Charlotte and I'll do it together."
"Bugger that, Adam,"
Molly muttered.
"Don't do it."
Flood enfolded a hand over the girl's shoulder. Fool fixed his bright eyes on her. "I won't be gone more than a night, Molly. You and Japheth will continue with our work in the meantime. I'll be back to see it through." Molly scowled.
"And if you're not?"
Flood rose up wrathful and elemental and smelling of the city's alleys, and he glared down at Fool in silence, and then he pressed past towards the door.
"Molly,"
he called over one shoulder,
"come on, kid. We've heard enough."
Molly gave Fool a sullen glower.
"You've got to ask yourself what's important,"
she said, and then she, too, swept past and was gone. The room was quiet. Fool grimaced and stared down at the opened crate, the mess of batting strewn from its opening like a spill of innards, the mask grinning face up from the floor. He could hear Molly's angry footsteps overhead, then the low, shuddering tread of Flood behind her. A door banged somewhere in the house.
"Will you do it, then?"
Charlotte said from behind him.
"Have you decided?"
Fool turned, studied her.
"The child doesn't approve?"
"Molly's like a daughter to me. I don't require her approval."
"What?"
"Maybe she's not mistaken, Adam.
No good can come of this."
"Of what?"
Charlotte glided forward.
"Us."
Fool stiffened, but did not move away.
"I need to ask you something. When you wrote me the letter..."
"Yes."
He forced himself to meet her eye. "Did you already think I was Shade? Did you think I was the man Pinkerton wanted when you brought me into this?" Charlotte paused.
"You are asking if I lured you here, to Pinkerton?"
"I am." She said nothing, and all at once, Fool felt strangely, obscurely ashamed. Then she turned without speaking and went to the door. When she looked back, her eyes were slitted and hurt.
"If you think me capable of that," she began.
But she did not finish. It was, he would reflect later, A most impressive performance. On Tuesday, Flood rented the farrier's battered old growler and piled it with their trunks and travelling cases, and he and Molly rode south in their heavy coats towards Newington. Fool stood with Mrs. Sykes at the parlour window and watched them go. In the mid-morning, he took Charlotte by hansom to collect a list of items needed for their pursuit of her uncle. They bought tickets for the Portsmouth stage, due to depart at 4 o'clock the following morning.
Mr. and Mrs. Balderdash?
Yes,
B-A-L-D-E, I see, sir. Thank you.
They drifted through the shops, her hand resting lightly on his wrist, his cane clicking as they went. Parcels were wrapped, sent on ahead to Half Moon Street. They strolled among the crowds on the Strand, their breath visible in the chill, and they ridiculed the theatre posters in St. Martin's Lane, and all the while Fool kept his eyes low, but he saw neither police nor Pinkerton. In the early afternoon they went down to the Thames and walked the embankment under the leafless trees, and Fool had the eerie sensation that he was living a borrowed life. He thought of how he might have lived, had things been otherwise, had the ordinary creep of time not stretched on. At Blackfriars Bridge they paused in the span, and Charlotte stared down at the Thames swirling thickly below, and at the barges passing under them, and Fool felt a shiver go through him. The day was dark. The afternoon was dark.
"Is this the place?" he asked. "Is this where you jumped?"
She was quiet.
"You're all secrets," he said.
She looked reprovingly at him. The traffic crossing the bridge was loud, the shouts of men in heavy scarves over the backs of horses, a drove of pigs rattling angrily on to the slaughter yards. The stone railing under his glove gave off a low thrum.
"You have no faith in people," she said. "I'd have had faith in our son."
He had not meant to say it, and he looked up at her in surprise.
"Forgive me."
Her thin eyebrow sharpened.
"My son," she said, "is dead."
"Yes."
"He died in Kent."
They were quiet then. Some figure, bundled in rags, had run to the railing farther down the bridge, was hurling a packet of papers into the river. Fool watched the scatter of papers, the slow spread of sheets in the water as they sank from view. A man in a blue frock coat was hollering. Charlotte shook her head. She said,
"I came from over there. It was night. William Pinkerton was behind me and not stopping. It was like being charged by a bull. I knew as soon as I'd turned into the traffic here that I'd made a mistake. I climbed over the rail, there. I stood on the parapet, and then I just let go."
Her face was far away, her eyes staring down at the freezing river below.
"I thought I'd die," she said. "I couldn't feel anything, and I just kept thinking of my baby."
She had lowered her voice so that Fool had to strain to hear her.
"There was a river near where our carriage overturned," she said. "I remember we walked down to it, and I bundled him up and set him in a little basket. The river was high. I lost sight of him at once. I kept thinking about that."
Fool shifted his feet. The papers long since lost to the waters, the fuliginous river muscling brutally past.
"We were trapped on that road for 3 nights," she whispered. "It was a terrible place. The river high and in flood, and me with nothing in my arms."
Fool was shaking his head, and he stared a hard stare at the murky Thames, and he gripped the stone railing, and he thought of the Confederate carriage he had nearly drowned in 20 years before, the black water in his lungs, the desperate soldier kicking at him for purchase. He thought of Alan Pinkerton, in silhouette, watching him ride southward to his death. Charlotte put a small gloved hand on his sleeve. Something went through him, a shiver.
"What is done out of love must be judged through love," she said. "You said that to me once."
His eyes drifted down to her gloved wrist, the crescent of skin visible between the kid skin and her cuff.
"You don't remember?"
"I'd sooner remove a man's hands than let him cut me twice," he said, his eyes clear. "I don't care the reason." He ran the tip of his tongue along his eye teeth. A knot of birds lifted from the far embankment like a shudder in the air. The sky darkened, the river deepened, bruising. Steamer ferries with small fires burning on their decks were paddling the waters downriver.
"We should go," he said. "Tomorrow we'll come early. There's much still to do."
But he was watching her as he spoke, and she looked up at him, and there was in her face a sadness he had not seen there before.
"You have changed," she said.
40. In the morning, the city loomed, soot-stained, teeming. William left his hotel and wended his way through narrow, cobbled lanes wreathed in fog, and came out into the roar of men and horses and carriages sliding on the icy sets under railway arches, and through all this he walked with his hat low and his gloved fists at his sides. He was thinking all the while on Ellen Shorter's husband. That man's love had first destroyed itself, and then destroyed her, leaving nothingness and loss in its place. William had lived his life among such men, and still he did not know what it was in a person that led to such brutality. He did not believe men were made for violence, and yet somehow savagery was ever near at hand. "In you, as in any," he thought. As he waited for a break in the traffic, he glimpsed, distorted, in a glass shop display, his own reflection dark and faceless and rippling among the clerks surrounding, like a creature out of nightmare. He looked away. It was Wednesday. He walked as far as Half Moon Street, and there he paused and stared up at the Emporium. He could see at once that Fool, Shade, was gone, the curtains drawn, the chimneys cold and dead. He had not noticed before the ragged brickwork, its cinder bricks standing out from the façade, like footholds for climbing. He set a gloved hand on the iron gate, glanced back along the street. Margaret would have told him, "There is no living in regret. You make the choices in the moment, and then you live with them." When the front door opened, William turned, surprised. It was Fool's housekeeper, a stout, powerful woman with a shawl wrapped tight at her shoulders and a bonnet askew. Hard, intelligent eyes.
"The master's not at home," she called. "Whatever it is you're wanting."
William stepped forward. "Do you expect him back soon?" A pause, her face squashing in concentration.
"You. You was by the house 2 weeks back."
William paused. "Yes."
"You was mighty rough with the wee one."
He opened the gate and came through and approached. "That was a misunderstanding," he said, "and I do regret it. I'm an acquaintance of Mr. Fool's. Is the child here? Could I tell her so myself?"
"She's gone out of the country, too. We're just to shuttering the house now, we are."
He climbed the steps and stood towering over her, and he could see her knuckles white in the cold where she gripped her shawl. Behind her, through the open door, he glimpsed the elegant interior, a dust sheet already drawn up over a pier table in the foyer. A ghost of a girl with a cleaning brush in one hand peered at him from the parlour doorway, and when he met her eye, she startled and vanished. "When do you expect Mr. Fool to return?"
"I wouldn't know that now. Commerce being commerce and all."
"More than a week, though, if you're closing up the house."
"Aye."
"More than a month?" She screwed up one eye, glared.
"It's the modern world. Keeps a poor man from sitting by his own fire."
"There must be some forwarding address. If I left a message..."
"Wouldn't reach him. Not for Lord knows how long."
He gave her a look. "What about Mr. Flood? Is he here?"
"Now look,"
she said sharply.
"My girl and me got a week's worth of work to get through in a day. You be off now, Mr. Pinkerton."
He looked up in surprise and met her gaze, and then he stepped closer.
"I know you,"
she scowled, sidling back.
"And I know you're kind, too."
"And what kind is that?" he said softly. Her lips tightened.
"You disappointed the master, something awful. Ought to be ashamed, where you carry on. Persecuting a good man like that."
And she turned and shut the door firmly, and after a moment, William heard the bolts rasp into place, and though he had not moved, he had the eerie feeling he had passed a threshold there was no returning from. He looked at his shoes, uneasy. He stared out at the street. In the sky, a great brown drift of fog thickened and slid past. But Fool was not gone yet, whatever that housekeeper claimed. This he knew with the same cold certainty that told him the elegant thief had been the architect behind the Emma heist. At a restaurant in a deserted square, he sat at a window and, while he ate, he withdrew from his coat the old photograph of his father's operatives in Cumberland. The blurred, boyish figure of shade, visible there. He stared at the boy. Then he stared at his father, bearded, savage, fierce, one hand creeping into his frock coat as if towards a weapon. How unlikely, he thought, that the boy he'd trained and the son he'd raised would someday stalk each other in a foreign city, haunted by separate griefs. He set the photograph aside and looked out at the February cold. In the afternoon he made his way to Scotland Yard and found Shaw in his shirt sleeves, hat off, head cradled on his desk, snoring. William had come noisily in and he stared at the man in surprise, spotted red skin visible through his hair.
"William," Shaw muttered,
lifting his face and rubbing at his whiskered cheeks with open palms, grimacing sleepily. "I didn't mean to wake you.
Come in. Shut the door, for God's sake."
William shut the door and stood turning his hat in his fingers.
"Rough morning. Rough night. Some lunatic's been hammering away at the whores south of Ludgate, starting to upset the honest folk."
He scraped at a nostril with a thumbnail, snorted.
"Never mind it. You've seen the papers? George Farquhar calls in here near every day. Just can't sit still. Well, it must be trying for him."
"Trying for him?" Shaw grunted. "You have no notion the pressure I'm under. George Farquhar dines regularly with Lord Hattersby. He keeps the Council of Half Parliament. This is not a man I'd like to see ruined, not on my watch."
William frowned in sympathy.
"No word yet from the thief,"
Shaw added. "I expect that should come through in the next day or two. We're to meet at Mr. Farquhar's residence when that happens." Shaw raised his eyes, paused.
"Your presence has been requested?"
"Mine?
Why, seems Farquhar wants to hire you, to ensure his safety or some such."
"He's decided to go along with the exchange, then?" "Never doubted he would, man like that."
Shaw wrestled into his frock coat, set his hat on his head.
"I'm sorry about it, William."
"So there'll be no charges laid?"
"Aye, and no legal grounds to collar the bastards that did this. Seems your rogue's file on Mr. Shade will have to wait a while yet."
But Shaw's face as he said this was drawn and gentle and disappointed on William's behalf, and there was no trace of mockery in it.
"Mr. Blackwell informs me you had some success in closing that Charlotte Rickett case," he said.
"Well, it wasn't her."
"No."
William rubbed at his old knee injury, starting to ache.
"It's strange," he said, and smiled a faint smile. "There's no evidence she's even dead. Maybe she'll resurface. Maybe she'll prove my lead back to Shade after all. Imagine that."
He looked up. "Unless Farquhar were to change his mind."
"I think not. He means to negotiate."
"On whose advice?"
"He wants his property returned, William. I can understand it."
"Edward Shade did this, John.
I'm sure of it."
"Doesn't matter. You can't move on a man without cause."
"I'll find cause."
"Not in London, you won't. Must I say it again? Last thing I need is some notorious American detective turned vigilante."
William paused. He looked at Shaw, at the man's long, calculating glare, and all at once something clicked into place.
"What is it?" he said. "Did Breck finish dusting the letter?"
Shaw's eyes shrank to small points of light.
"All this time," he said, "I thought you were chasing a ghost. You and your father."
He took out his pipe and lit it. He nudged the box of tobacco towards William, and the two men sat in a slow white wreath of smoke.
"Aye, they're a match,"
Shaw said at last. "The fingerprints belong to your Edward Shade."
"Son of a bitch," William muttered. "I knew it."
"But you can't do a thing with it, William."
He looked up and met the other's eye.
"Not legally, I can't," he said.
41. The Portsmouth stage rattled south into the red of the rising sun, and Fool and Charlotte sat stained by its glow, the red light slatted over their faces, their huddled shoulders, their gloves shuddering on the blankets in their laps. A freezing wind whistled through the crack and carried on the wind with the voices of the driver and the young passenger riding crow's seat. The driver was an older man with thick brown mutton chops and a green scarf, double-wrapped at his throat, and his gloves had been sliced at the fingers. In the half-dark of the inn-yard where the stage began, the driver had stood blowing into his fingers and studying his customers coolly, and he had not helped load the trunks to the roof, but had climbed up after and lashed them fast. Charlotte seemed disconsolate. She stared out at the passing fields, saying little, her small mouth down-turned, while the farmhouses, with white smoke rising from their chimneys, slid past, the long sinuous hedgerows marking the grazing land. Fool watched her from the corner of his eye, but did not disturb her. He felt a slow bloom of sadness coming up in him, but could not account for it. The only other passenger was an elderly man with wire-rimmed spectacles and an unfashionable silk hat, and he smiled and nodded when he caught Fool's eye.
"A fine thing, getting up out of the smoke," he said. "To Portsmouth, is it?"
Fool shook his head. "Chichester. My wife's sister. She's ailing, I fear."
"Ah,"
the man said, withdrawing slightly, glancing at Charlotte, glancing back.
"A shame, that. You wouldn't be from thereabouts yourself, though."
"No.
I allowed maybe you weren't, on account of your—"
And the man waved a hand back and forth in front of his face.
"My what?"
The man blinked behind his spectacles, uncertain.
"Why, your complexion," he said.
They rattled along in silence then for a time, and then the man said,
"Had a sister myself once. Funny little teeth. We used to call her Peggers, on account of them. Well, all in the past now."
The elderly man leaned forward over his leather satchel.
"She had three little ones, all dead inside of a year. Fourth one took her with it."
He clicked his tongue, remembering.
"A poor affair, that was."
Fool glanced out the window.
"What ails your sister-in-law?"
"Disease," he said blackly.
"A shame,"
the man said again.
"And so young, too, I wager."
The stage rattled and banged and clattered on. Fool tried to fix his gaze on the passing scenery and thereby discourage the man from further conversation. By noon, the stage had arrived in Guildford, and Fool and Charlotte got down at the local inn and stood in the yard with their two modest trunks standing under the cover of the front entrance, and Charlotte went inside for a bite to eat, and Fool followed. The only course on offer was a bowl of beef stew, thick with onions and carrots, and Fool ate heartily, but Charlotte set her spoon aside, her face pale, and did not eat. After lunch, they walked out past the chicken yard, until they reached a small stable at the end of the lane, and Charlotte went inside and asked for Hadfield Crook.
"That isn't his real name,"
Fool said with a smile.
"It can't be."
She smiled vaguely. A short, clean-shaven man with a birthmark covering half his neck came out, still struggling into his frock coat.
"How can I be of help, then?" he said.
"Mr. Crook,
aye?"
"We wrote ahead,"
Charlotte said.
"We were told the carriage was for hire."
The man grunted.
"One surely is, ma'am."
But what he presented to them was not a carriage, but an open wagon with an ancient ship-ribbed mare attached, and Fool took one disgusted look at the condition of its wheels and turned to go.
"Suit yourself," the man Crook said, "but you'll find no other. Folks round here don't hire out what they need themselves."
Fool tipped his hat. "We'll find another. Charlotte." But Charlotte had walked over to the shaggy mare, set a hand on its flank.
"Pay the man," she said. "We'll take this one."
They loaded their trunks into the bed of the wagon and set off by early afternoon on the Midhurst Road. The going was slow in places, with the churned mud frozen into ragged crests in the ruts. They were in West Sussex, in the middle of the Western Weald, and passed alongside stands of oak and rolling hills marked with medieval boundary stones, and all of it blue and gloomy, where a cold winter mist hung low to the ground, swelling up around the creaking of their wagon's wheels, then coalescing and closing up in their wake, as if they had never been. At Midhurst they got down into the biting chill, and unhitched and fed the miserable creature in the yard of an inn. The ground was barren, snowless, hard. In the common room they called for a glass of porter and two hot ciders, and stood with their hands to the fire, speaking to no one. Then they harnessed their mare and climbed back up and crossed the River Rother, and rode the 3 miles south into Heyshott. The village looked gloomy, deserted. They passed St. James's Church and its spindly tombstones, and the small unfenced green where a lone dog trotted past, and they drew up outside the Unicorn pub. Both Charlotte and Fool took note of the ebony carriage next to the stables, with its royal insignia and its barred windows and its twin lanterns already lit in the failing light. That would be the prisoner's transport. Charlotte rummaged in her trunk and took out a thick wool coat and a pair of men's breeches and stiff new boots and stuffed them all into a long satchel, and then they went inside. They took a table at the back of the room. The pub was crowded, smoky, a low orange wood fire burning in the grate, and Fool looked at Charlotte, but she seemed distant, watchful, cold. The prisoners were not, of course, among them.
"I don't see him," Fool said.
Charlotte did not answer, but got to her feet and stood waiting, and after a moment, a guard in a red coat and brass buckler, and wearing a truncheon at his hip, came over to their table. He held a half-full tankard in one fist, and he nodded soberly to the two of them.
"You lot down from London, then?" he said pleasantly.
Charlotte studied him with a cold eye.
"Sit, Mr. Bailey, do," she said.
"I allowed it was you," the man said, lowering his voice. "We're just to change in the horses now."
Charlotte had taken from inside her coat a small felt pouch, and it clinked as she set it on the table.
"That marks the rest of it," she said.
Bailey glanced uneasily about, snatched it up, pocketed it.
"Where is he?"
she said. A sly grin.
"Being seen to. There's 17 of them in the links. Gotta be fed the old peas pottage. A little something to wash it down with. Quick step to shitshed."
He tipped his hat, begging your pardon.
"How will you manage it?"
"Oh, run him to the tunny last. How much do we know? He won't start hollering up a piece, will he?"
When neither answered, Bailey shrugged.
"Well, I'll manage the count when we're backloaded. Shouldn't be noticed until we get to Portsmouth."
He gave Charlotte a quick, fierce look.
"And that's my work in full, then?"
Fool frowned.
"How soon until you depart?"
Bailey shrugged.
"Quarter of an hour, all told. Less. I'm already out the door. You lot don't leave much margin for error, do you? I was thinking maybe you got cold feet."
"It was a slow road in," Charlotte said. "Just get him to the privy, Mr. Bailey. We'll see to the rest."
They waited 10 minutes and then got up and went out into the cold, and walked around the outside of the pub and stood at the corner as the afternoon daylight faded and they watched the guard, Bailey, frog-marched the prisoners one by one to the outhouse and take them back. They could hear the other two guards barking orders, and the heavy rattle of chains, and lastly they saw Bailey lead a frail old man out to the privy, and enter it with him, and the door shut behind them. A minute passed. Two. Then Bailey came out alone and slipped back towards the transport, and climbed up inside to start locking the leg irons into place.
"Wait,"
Thor said. He set a hand on Charlotte's arm. She looked at him.
"Wait,"
he said again.
"I'll go first."
The thick doors of the transport wagon shut, were locked, double locked, and then the two guards climbed up front and one climbed into the perch at the back of the wagon, and the horses were snapped into motion, and the transport rolled out at speed. He pulled away from Charlotte and crossed the pale clay yard, and banged open the door of the rickety wooden privy. And there sat Martin Reckitt, frail, confused, blinking in his brown prisoner shoe. He stared up in astonishment.
"You," he said, "this is your doing."
Fool held the door open a crack for light to see by. The privy was narrow, its walls awash in filth, and a powerful reek of ancient shit and urine. Martin Reckitt looked grey, his skin bleached of colour, his eyes pale. The only colour, the sore red rims around them, and the rashes on his throat, and the backs of his hands. Fool could see nothing of the dangerous man he had met at Millbank, only a befuddled and miserable creature. He crouched. He studied the chains at the man's ankles. He knew the locks. Double Frobishers, now 30 years out of date. They would not be difficult to spring.
"What are you doing?"
the old man said.
"What is this?"
"How much were you told?"
Reckitt's head shuddered on his neck. Imperceptible. Old.
"Kill me quickly,"
the old man hissed.
"If you have the nerve for it."
But just then the door was pulled from Fool's grasp, and he turned in sudden fury. But it was only Shard, pressing in behind him, and he looked back in time to see Martin Reckitt, open-mouthed, sight his living niece in the flesh. The privy latticed in shadow and light, the three of them crowded inside. Martin Reckitt trembled. He leaned unsteadily towards her, and then he embraced her.
"Lord God in heaven, all that is holy," he murmured. "My Lord, my God."
He turned his face in wonder to Fool, and Fool could smell the black stink of the old man's breath.
"How is this possible?"
His hands trembling.
"We haven't the time,"
Charlotte said abruptly, pulling back.
"Adam, the chains."
He made his way back out and collected his small black pouch of picking tools from his trunk, and he glanced quickly around him, and then returned to the privy. He kneeled in the filth of the floor next to the open hole, and he worried away at the fetters, and had them off in minutes, and he kicked the chains into the pit with a splash. Charlotte had opened her satchel and pulled out the clothes, and Fool began to help the old man undress. They kept elbowing up against the cold walls, and the wood there was slick with some foul matter. The old man's skin was streaked with grime, a welt of sores in bloom on his belly and his thighs.
"Charlotte," the old man said, unashamed. "My little Charlotte."
"Later," Fool said sharply. "We need to be gone now."
The old man, pale and eerie in the early gloaming, did not look at Fool, might not even have heard. Charlotte herself was staring with anguish at her uncle, as if at a stranger, and then she saw Fool watching, and her face closed over, and she pushed at the door and was gone. They rode out of the roadhouse yard, crowded onto the box of the wagon, and the tired thin mare straining at her harness, and the darkness already descending in the east. A line of bright grey sky, almost white in its shining, was visible above the western horizon, and even as they rode out of headshot into the Weald, it started to fade and go down. Martin sat in the middle, frail, shivering, his face turned towards Charlotte. No one spoke. Fool could not gauge the old man's expression, but he could see the deep frown at Charlotte's eye, where she strained not to look back at him. The shadow rode unscrolled before them. Fool did not know what was in Charlotte, but he knew it was not joy, not relief. At last they could go no farther, and they drew the wagon roughly off the road into a stand of oaks, and walked some 30 paces farther on, and found the remains of an old fire pit. Blackened stones, the charred remains of some feral creature. In the twilight, Fool collected dead branches and scooped an armful of hay from the back of the wagon and set about lighting a fire. With a sudden whoosh, the straw caught and flared and bloomed up into flame. He stepped back, waved the sparks from his face with his hat.
"It's still got the wet in it," he said. "There won't be much heat."
Martin said nothing. Fool could not see Charlotte and supposed she had gone back to the wagon to collect some food.
"At least there's light,"
he muttered.
"There is always a light," Martin said quietly. "If only we cared to see it."
Fool crouched on his haunches, stirred a branch deeper into the fire.
"We imagine we stand at the center of the story, but we do not,"
Martin said, peering up at Fool. His eyes reflected the firelight.
"I see that now. It is not your story, Adam Fool, that you find yourself in, nor is it mine. It belongs to the Lord and the Lord only, and he will tell it as he will."
Fool saw in the old man's ravaged face the weight of his solitary bitterness, and he understood something had twisted inside the man that could not be sorted out. It was not madness, not exactly, but a kind of warping all the same. He looked up. The last of the day's light had slipped away.
"We'll need to find something to eat," he said after a time.
How hungry are you? The old man seemed not to hear. He was seated on a wind-fallen tree, staring into the fire, slow-eyed, his head trembling on its thin stalk of a neck.
It is not my flesh that hungers, he said. I have no words for this.
And he held out his claw-like hands to the fire.
That is a terrible thing, Adam Fool, to have lived by words and to lose them at such a moment.
Fool looked at him. What moment would that be? But the old man did not answer. When Charlotte emerged out of the darkness behind her uncle, she appeared like a grey ghost, her face bloodless, and she wrapped one slender arm around the old man's forehead and snapped his head back, and the other hand inserted a blade under the carotid artery and punched it forward. A black spray of blood crossed the mossy earth, and then a sheet of it poured downward out of his throat and over his frock coat and his knees. He gave out a strangled groan, and his eyes rolled back in his head, and he pitched forward into the dirt. Fool was on his feet.
Charlotte! He cried. Jesus!
She stood breathing, and she looked up at him in horror, and then she started to shake. The old man lay face down, his blood steaming out into the frozen earth. She said nothing. She stood with the dagger still clutched in her hand. Fool stepped back out of the firelight. All at once, he understood.
You meant this, he said, all this time. This was your intent.
She stared through Fool, not seeing him, and then she came to and gave a small shiver and turned away. He watched her gather her belongings and stuff them into a small satchel, and he followed her down to the hired wagon. She unhobbled the horse and backed it slowly into its harness. She paused. He could see her breath in the cold.
5 years ago, a man approached me in a pub in Lambeth. He thought I was a whore. He said I was the spitting image of a woman he'd once fancied. Turned out, that was my mother.
Fool stood shivering in the cold night. The fire was burning in the trees beyond.
He told me an account of my father. Said he was a clever man, a good man. Fell afoul of very bad people. Said they killed him. Ruined my mother. Killed her, too, in their way. I went to the old neighborhood where we'd lived. Found others who remembered them. Remembered me. I heard from several the name of the man who did it. There was no mistaking it.
Martin.
She nodded. She was starting to shake in earnest now, and her eyes looked wild.
He did it, Adam, she whispered. He killed my father. He had my mother and me run out of our lodgings. When he came for me in the workhouse, it wasn't mercy. It was revenge.
You could have left him to rot. You could have left him to die in Portsmouth.
Would you? Would you have done so?
Fool pursed his lips. He thought of his own father. He thought of Mrs. Shade. He thought of Alan Pinkerton's fatherly hand gripping his shoulder.
Where will you go now? He said. What will you do? I don't want you to remember me like this, she said. You must think me a villain. I don't. You will.
Her body was trembling violently now.
Wait,
he said. He went back and dragged his trunk down the slope and threw it up onto the bed of the wagon. In the lamplight, he opened the lid and took out a heavy blanket and a bag of salt crackers, and his black pouch of lock-picking tools, and then he shut the lid and stepped away.
You could come with me, she said.
But he could not. He shook his head. He studied her shocked face in the faint light, thinking how it was something he would not see again, thinking it was a face he had not ever really seen. Not truly. She did not ask him twice. She gathered the reins and turned the horse. As she rode off, the single orange lantern swayed and flickered and was gradually lost to view. If she glanced back, he did not see it.
42. William and Shaw were let into George Farquhar's upstairs study by